minutes, and then let's do it. Okay, well, let's go ahead and call the roll. So. All right, good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Beth Kidder. I'm the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Medicaid Operations. I'm sitting in to help facilitate today for Justin Sr., who is out of the office today. We have a very full agenda today, so I'm going to go ahead and have Ms. Sims call the roll, and we'll check to see in a minute. We'll open the lines to see if there are any committee members on the phone.
Okay.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Secretary Charles Corley, Ellen Anderson, Amy Guinan, Dr. Moffitt, Dr. Thacker,
here.
Dr. Payne,
here.
Stan Whitaker,
here.
Martha Pierce, I believe is on the line, Michael Lockwood, Tracy Inman, Irish Guyton, Sarah Sequencia.
Okay. Were there any, if there are any members on the line, if you heard your name called but weren't able to get in, can you speak up now?
David Poole's on the line from Positive Healthcare.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm going to put the audience on background mute now.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Do we have a quorum? Okay. I think we can proceed with the public meeting portion of this. So. Okay. Well, I wanted to go over, this meeting's a little bit different than some of the other ones that we've had in the past in that we are, we have a number of, actually three different public meeting functions that are being fulfilled by this meeting, which I think is also why our audience is so large today. So I'll just briefly go over what we're going to do today. I did also want to let you know that because these are public meetings and we have a public comment period after each of our different presentations, we are recording this, and to make sure that everything's adequately captured, we're recording this. We have a court reporter here today. So just to go over the agenda and explain a little bit about how this will work, the first part of this is what's called the post-award forum for the 1115 waiver. As part of the conditions of the approval of our waiver, we are 1 year into the implementation or the beginning of the waiver. We're to hold a forum to get feedback from the public and stakeholders on how the program is going. So the way that we'll do that is very shortly we'll have a presentation by David Rogers, kind of set the stage for that, and then we will open up for comments. First from the Medical Care Advisory Committee members and then from members of the public who wish to speak on that. That will go from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock. And then we'll switch gears. For those on the phone, what we ask you to do in order to be recognized is that you, if you wish to make a comment, we ask that you email in and let us know that you wish to make a comment and your name so that we can call on you. We can either have the lines open or we can have them closed. And so we want to be able to call people out in an orderly way. So the email address, if you wish to make a comment, is flmedicaidwaivers, that's flmedicaidwaivers@aca.myflorida.com. Again, flmedicaidwaivers@aca.myflorida.com. And you can send in at any time. If you could let us know which portion of the meeting you'd wish to speak to, that will help us in calling people who are on the line. And I will repeat that again as we go through each phase of the meeting. The second part of this is a proposed amendment to the 1115 waiver. We just got it renewed, but as always, there's policy changes that are coming and are continually being amended into the waiver. And so we'll have a brief presentation by Siobhan Harris on what the proposed changes are to the waiver, and then we will open up for public comment on that portion of it. That'll take about half an hour. Okay, and again, we'll open the lines after we first heard from the committee members and the people in the room. If you wish to speak to that and you're on the phone, again, email in, please. And then we'll have a brief presentation from Nathan Lewis from our sister agency, Department of Children and Families, about some positive developments in the area of Medicaid eligibility, and he wants to update you on that. And then we will close this portion of the meeting with a presentation on our comprehensive quality strategy. This is also a federal requirement that we have this strategy. There'll be an explanation by Marie Donnelly, our Bureau Chief for Quality, and talking about the quality strategy. And then we will have some question and answer session here and some opportunity for comment here. But most of the conversation will take place in the subgroups. We specifically are required to have our subgroups discuss and comment on this particular plan. And so there'll be an opportunity here to get some kind of basic information and baseline understanding, and then we'll break out into our different subgroups for more detailed discussion of the quality strategy. So I will pause there for a second and ask the committee members if you have any questions about how that will work, because it's a little bit different than what we normally do. Yes, Dan. Yeah.
Quality is a draft, right? It's not accepted.
It is. It is a draft plan. We have a comment period open, and we'll talk about that. We have a 30-day comment period that's open on that plan right now. We then look at all the comments, incorporate any of those that need to be incorporated, and then we send it to the federal government, who then has to approve it before it's final. This is something that we update every year. This is an update of an existing plan. Yes, and thank you, Millie. So because there are people on the phone and because we are recording this, we ask that you use the microphones. We have several around, and so if you can just pause long enough to pick up one of the mics that's at the corners, that will help everybody who's trying to listen in on the phone as well as for recording purposes. Okay. So if you are in the room and you're interested in making a comment on any of the different sections that we go through, please submit a comment card to me prior to the end of each presentation. And actually, if you could give those to Carla, Carla Sims, here in the peach coral sweater. She's walking that way. And that will help us to be able to call on people to go ahead and make their comments. And when we do call on you, we'll ask you to stand up. We'll bring you a microphone so that, again, we can hear and understand all your comments. Okay, so as noted on the first item of business, we are using this Medical Care Advisory Committee as a forum to offer meaningful comments on the progress of the 1115 demonstration waiver. So with that, I will turn this over to David Rogers, our Assistant Deputy Secretary for Health Systems, who will go over, give you kind of a broad overview of the waiver, and then we'll open up the discussion and comment on this portion.
Great, thank you, Beth. I probably need. Do I need a mic, Millie?
Yes, you do. And just to remind everybody, even if you have a voice that projects so that you can hear it in the room, we won't be able to pick it up for recording purposes. And trust me, I've been on enough conference calls on the phone, you will not hear, the people on the phone will hear nothing. So please bear with us as we move the mics around.
Great. Okay, thank you, Beth. You should have in your packet a brief presentation titled Post-Award Forum. As it starts, or at least I will do my best to make this brief. As Beth mentioned, I'd like to give a little bit of an overview, some context around the program, and then we'll open it up for comments, questions, input from both the committee and then others that have joined us here or on the phone. So we'll start on the really the first slide titled Statewide Medicaid Managed Care Program, just as a reminder to everyone that Florida Medicaid has changed significantly as a result of statewide Medicaid managed care. That was legislation that was passed in 2011. Now most Medicaid recipients in the state of Florida receive their Medicaid services, their health care services, through managed care plans. The statewide Medicaid managed care program has two different components. One is the long-term care program, sometimes you'll hear referred to as the LTC program, and then the managed medical assistance program, or what is often referred to as the MMA program. It's interesting to note that these two different components operate under a different federal authority. So Medicaid is, most of you I'm sure know, is a federal and state partnership that works, you know, the states work jointly with the federal government. And in order to essentially waive certain federal requirements for the program, it requires that the state actually request that authority from the federal government. And so for the long-term care, there was a separate request that was done under a section of the Social Security Act, Section 1915. And then for the MMA program, that request was done, again, under a separate authority referred to as Section 1115. So our post-award forum today is specifically related to the managed medical assistance program, or the 1115 waiver authority. As Beth mentioned, it's actually included in the special terms and conditions for that waiver authority that we hold this post-award forum. But it sometimes is very difficult to kind of tease out the differences in the program between long-term care and MMA, and we'll get into that a little bit more. So, but I just wanted to provide that context around the different federal authorities for the two programs. So if you go to the next slide, the 1115 waiver history, again, just a little bit of a, you know, kind of walk back in time here. This is the federal authority, the same federal authority that was used for Medicaid reform, the pilot project that was initially implemented in 2006. So you see the initial period on this slide from July of 2006 through June 2011. Those initial periods are usually for 5 years with an 1115 waiver. And then we've had an extension beyond the, again, past 2011. We've had an amendment. The amendment that's referenced in June 2013 provided the specific authority for the Managed Medical Assistance, or the MMA program. And then, as Beth alluded to in her opening remarks, we've done an additional 3-year extension on that waiver authority. So the current waiver authority for the MMA program, again, it's a component of the statewide Medicaid managed care program. It the current waiver authority expires in June of 2017. We do have authority in the waiver to continue our low-income pool program, but that authority only extends for 1 year through the end of June 2015. There are a couple of other things besides the MMA program that are worthy to note in terms of the federal authority. The waiver authority does continue our ability to operate some programs and receive federal Medicaid funding, and that would include the Healthy Start program, the program for all-inclusive care for children. That's actually operated as a part of the Children's Medical Service Network. And then our comprehensive hemophilia program. All of those programs have been in existence, and again, the current waiver authority allows us to continue those. I'll just mention also there's a reference there to the special terms and conditions, or STCs as they're sometimes referred to. Those are actually provisions within the waiver authority that kind of codify certain agreements between the state and the federal government in terms of requirements that will be met for the waiver. So Beth mentioned, and I've talked about, this post-award forum being a requirement of the special terms and conditions. There are many other consumer protections and other requirements that are built into those special terms and conditions. So, for example, increasing the membership for the Medical Care Advisory Committee, including the subcommittees, which we'll meet to talk about the quality strategy later in the day. Those are actually part of the agreement between the state and the federal government that are embodied in the special terms and conditions. The quality strategy itself and some of the content of the quality strategy, again, are part of those special terms and conditions that are embedded in there. As we get to the MMA program and implementation, there are some kind of procedural, practical things, I guess, also. So an implementation plan that was required as part of special terms and conditions, reports before going live in each region that were required as part of the special terms and conditions, and then routine calls, weekly calls, in fact, were specified with our federal partners at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services as we've gone through the program implementation. On slide five, the managed care plan types. If you don't know, there are several different types of managed care plans that can offer services under the Managed Medical Assistance Program. So we have what we refer to as standard plans. Those can be either HMOs that are licensed, regulated under Chapter 641, Florida statute, or provider service networks, which are kind of majority provider-owned entities. But those standard plans require those services that are mandatory to be in the benefit package for the Managed Medical Assistance Program. All of those standard plans offer expanded benefits as well beyond that that required benefit package. But we also have specialty plans. The specialty plans are plans that, again, provide that required benefit package that can and do provide expanded benefits, and but that are targeted towards a very specific subpopulation of Medicaid recipients. So when we did the procurement for the MMA program, the invitation to negotiate actually contemplated two specific types of specialty plans, one being a plan for persons with HIV and AIDS, and the other a child welfare plan. But the ITN allowed other specialty plans to be offered. It wasn't restrictive to just those two that were contemplated. So we did award contracts to a plan for persons with serious mental illness, as well as a plan for dual eligibles, or those individuals that were dually eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid who have chronic disease. And then the Children's Medical Services is a statewide specialty plan. Should note it was not subject to the procurement. It was actually specified in statute that the agency would contract with the Children's Medical Services program operated by the Department of Health. And then comprehensive plans are just simply those that include long-term care. Slide six, you'll see the kind of the regions. I think you've probably seen that before. On slide seven, just included our regional rollout schedule. We did do a phase rollout schedule. That was for a number of reasons, but we wanted to make sure we had the bandwidth to accommodate the rollout, including data exchange. So we did quite a bit of data exchange with the plans prior to going live. And then the continuity of care provisions were really important for us as well. On slide eight, just for your reference, there's actual enrollment numbers that are effective as of this month. So these are the current enrollment numbers by plan and by region. And then number nine shows you our choice counseling process. The waiver requires that we provide a minimum of 30 days for individuals to select a plan. We actually began with a pre-welcome letter about 90 days prior to the effective enrollment date, and then did a notice 60 days prior with a reminder letter 30 days prior. We also had a web application and an IVR process for enrollment. Slide 10 has basically some numbers on the choice level, which is around 70% of the individuals are in a plan of their choosing. Again, either made an active selection during the process or had already chosen the plan that they were assigned to prior to rollout. And that number is going up because of new eligibles. It also doesn't include the voluntary population who either chose to enroll in a plan or chose not to choose and not enroll in a plan. Just to close out with the outreach efforts, I think, or some of our communication on slide 11 gives you a little bit of the numbers of the communications, the number of press releases, the number of webinars, social media hits on those webinars. Those are all posted on our website. We also had weekly calls with certain provider groups that are listed, again, just to get feedback from individuals during the rollout process, how it was going. On slide 12, we actually tried to use our website to try to get a lot of information out there. We had almost 9,000 individuals that were on a interested party list and received regular program updates for us, and we did quite a number of updates to frequently asked questions during the both long-term care and the MMA rollouts. And then probably another important way that we heard from people was through our centralized complaint process. That's on slide 13. So we actually developed an online process, but also took complaint intake through our contact center, through our Medicaid area offices. We did consolidate the input and reporting, and then through that process, generally our response time was within 24 hours to 48 hours the complainant was hearing back from us to get additional information. And we reviewed those complaints daily and then intervened with the plans. Again, sometimes they weren't plan-specific complaints. Our average response time or resolution time for recipient-reported issues was a little under 7 days, and then on the provider issues, about 11 and a half days. And just to clarify, it's really the time, that includes time for us to loop back with the complainant to actually make sure that their issue is resolved to their satisfaction. And then finally, I think I just put in there some numbers on the total issues logged. So about 6,500 since the implementation of SMMC, about 4,000 of those are MMA issues compared to 2,500 or so long-term care issues. That's an interesting proportion given that, again, there are about 85,000 individuals served by the long-term care program and close to 3 million, 2.7, I think, is the enrollment number that you have before you in the MMA program. Okay. So in some of the common issues, our largest category really related to continuity of care, that related to people just being worried about keeping their services as we transition. Again, a number of exemption requests, which was permissible under the reform project, but limited to certain exemptions specified under state law in the MMA program. Again, worries about continuity of care related to transportation, getting to appointments. Durable medical equipment, therapy, assistive care, probably a couple of big areas for us that we have looked at, have done some compliance actions on, and probably will continue to look at. And I think overall just the billing issues, those three that I mentioned, plus others such as behavioral health, is now becoming probably the biggest single area for us through our complaint hub. So with that, we'll kind of open it up and love for you to tell us, you know, what worked from your perspective, what didn't, and how we can do it better for next time.
Great. Thank you, David. So I'm going to repeat, before we open it up, I'm going to remind the folks in the room that if they would like to comment on the program, unless you're a member at the table, to give your comment cards to Carla Sims over here on this side of the room. If you are on the phone and you would like to comment, if you could please email us at flmedicaidwaivers@aca.myflorida.com. That will know that there's somebody on the line who wishes to speak, and I will call your name when it comes time to open up the phone lines. Again, flmedicaidwaivers, plural, that's plural, flmedicaidwaivers@aca.myflorida.com. Okay. With that, Carla, do we have anybody in? Well, let me start with the members at the table, and then I'll we have two folks from the public. Okay. Amy, go ahead.
Hello. Hi. For those on the phone, this is Amy Guinan with Florida Legal Services, and I'm very interested to hear from members of the public about their experiences. I want to make sure they have time to talk, so I'm going to be very brief, but I did just want to say that throughout this extremely complex system change, I think the agency really has gone to some extraordinary and unprecedented efforts to reach out to stakeholders. And for those of you who have had a chance to look through the comprehensive strategy draft that we're going to talk about later, you can see just how extensive those efforts were because they're laid out in that report. They're very impressive. And I have to say, I don't know who made the decision to appoint Melanie Baumwifter to the Director of Community Relations position, but they were brilliant because you couldn't ask for a better Director of Community Relations. I really appreciate all that she's done to help us with issues that we've spotted throughout implementation, as well as Bill Blocker in the General Counsel's office, who really worked hard on us. That being said, I do think that we can't forget or just stress enough just how truly tremendously huge this system change was. And whenever there is a system change like this, there's always going to be some glitches, and Medicaid beneficiaries are going to face possibly some new challenges and some initial barriers or difficulties accessing care in some cases. So in working with Medicaid beneficiaries going through the implementation process, some of the biggest issues that we saw was when Medicaid recipients' enrollment in a managed care plan was impacted in some way with information or access from or involvement from other agencies. For instance, children in foster care or Medicaid recipients on the APD waivers. And in those cases, when there was incorrect information or just a misunderstanding of how the process was going to work, there could be some big problems with whether or not the recipient was enrolled in the right program or if they faced some problems accessing services. So while I really just want to applaud all the outreach efforts and the work that ACA's done, I really just want to stress that the outreach efforts and the communications can't stop now, and it can't just be with ACA. It has to be with all of us involved, including other agencies, the providers, the HMOs, advocates, the beneficiaries. Now is the time, it's a very critical time, because those who didn't choose and weren't really aware of this implementation process could really be having some questions now as they go in for services and see that there was this huge change. So it's important now more than ever that we all keep communicating and identifying really what the problems are so we can work together to figure out how to fix them. So thanks.
Thank you. And I would echo that, that if you have, if you, the constituencies that you represent are in need of education, are in need of outreach from us, we are happy to do that, and we are continuing that. We are happy to do a webinar series. We're happy to do present to your groups. That invitation is open. We did a major series of webinars to education series, but we know that that education needs to continue. So if you have ideas for that, we are always open to that.
So, it was best call on Melanie, too. You're right. She's really
some help from him. So other members of the committee, Dr. Payne, if you would, could David, could you hand him the microphone? Thank you.
Robert Payne with the Florida Dental Association. Just an easy question. In this region, Region 2, there are two plans. One is Prestige. The other used to be WellCare, but now I see it's called StayWell. Is that the same company or is it a different company?
It's the same company.
Same company, just changed names?
They used to do business under StayWell and Healthies, and they selected StayWell as the name that will do business.
But same company.
Same company, yes. Dr. Thacker.
Hi. Rich Thacker. I'm an internist in here locally practicing Tallahassee. And I'm in Region 2. And before I ask a specific question about that, a general question is, are there any surprises in terms of the enrollments of the different companies in terms of people not meeting their minimum, or is anyone at their maximum? Are there any issues with enrollment numbers?
I would say there are no minimums or maximums. The plans are, we developed the plan network standards so that they would be actually double what they normally, what they would have been under the old world. And the idea for that was to ensure that if any other plan had to leave an area or withdrew from an area, that there would be at more than enough capacity. And it also was so that that a plan would essentially not have a limit on enrollment. So from that perspective, we don't guarantee a certain amount of enrollment to any plan. There really are limits on their networks, but it's so high that no one has reached that yet. Is that fair, David, from your perspective? Okay. I think in terms of surprises, I don't think so particularly.
Okay, good. That's good to know. And then a more specific question in regards to Region 2. As a primary care physician, I've noticed that there are some access issues. And I don't know, and I know we have a little breakdown in terms of the questions and complaints and things coming in, but access being a very general term, but I can tell you in our region that you might be able, you're pretty well assigned and okay with a primary care doc, but it's very difficult with specialists and referrals. And so what is our general feedback in terms of those specific complaints?
David, do you want to take that?
Yeah.
We see a variety of things that come by way of complaints with regard to access beyond the my provider's not in the network, which was a big continuity care issue for us. Either too far away or can't find someone. Again, we kind of deal with those complaints on the individual basis, try to get them to a provider, try to get them to a provider in the appropriate distance. We also have weekly reports from the plans on their provider networks, which we look at for these ratios. So on the complaint side, I think I don't have the numbers in front of me, but my observations are it's probably our complaints are more pronounced probably in the rural areas in Region 2 and Region 3. On the reporting side from the plan, we have done liquidated damages for, have to get the numbers exactly, I want to say about five plans that had not met provider standards, and we'll continue to do that. So it's really a two-prong approach to see what the beneficiaries are experiencing, use the complaint information, and then the reporting process. So I think it's probably, again, at least anecdotally based on the complaints, we see probably do see more of those in two and three.
Thank you. And in terms of complaints and perhaps for the next visit, can we get a little breakdown on that, even if we need to go in a closed session, you know, in the sense of, well, who are our problem children, so to speak, in terms of those plans? And so if we have a preponderance of concerns or complaints about one plan or another, and in one particular type of complaint, then perhaps we can give you a little bit more feedback and insight rather than talking in a lot of generalities,
you know,
on that.
We can certainly do that.
Thank you. And then another question, a follow-up question, and this is a little bit particular but not exclusive to Region 2, is that we're, you know, here in North Florida, we're bordering with Georgia. And so sometimes we have some access issues here in terms of specialist care. And so I have often referred my personal patients to Thomasville, Georgia, or other South Georgia or even Alabama clinics, particularly for specialty care. And so do we have a mechanism to do that? Because I can tell you in this region, absolutely, for certain specialties, even if they will accept them, it can be a six-month wait. And what's our feedback on that?
Yeah, we certainly recognize that. Actually, we have a longstanding policy that if a provider is within 50 miles of the state line, that they can be enrolled as a Florida Medicaid provider, fully enrolled. And that policy still stands. We put out specific clarification to the plans about that to make sure that they understood, especially for those that might be coming new into the Panhandle area and not perhaps understand the importance of those network connections that are close to the border and in our neighboring states. So we have put that out, and they can be part of those networks, and they are part of those networks. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Whitaker.
Stan Whitaker with the Florida Association of Nurse Practitioners. We've had some access problems from my particular profession as far as getting credentialed and impaneled with health plans. The other, and it seems to be a pretty lengthy process to get that approval to go through. And is there some way we can address maybe streamlining that a little bit would be much, much better. On the upside, we've had several of the plans working with us to try and work with that process. So we are looking at that and talking with the plans on trying to streamline that process. The other thing that we run into is the pre-approval or the referral process, getting the acknowledgement back when we're trying to send patients to cardiology or we're trying to send patients to neurology and having to get that approval form. The other is medications, is getting prior approval for certain medications. It takes quite a bit of time to get that as well. So from delivery of care point, that's been a bit of an issue.
Thank you for the feedback. I would just ask for everybody here that if you are having specific types of questions, we or concerns or problems, those are the kinds of issues we want to see in the hub. It is a secure online connection. You can send specific patient information, and we will work those issues, but it also helps us see the bigger trends. So that is really incredibly helpful to us if you will report those. In terms of credentialing, that is something that we recognize, that it is for providers that having to be credentialed by multiple different entities. So we are working on a project this year to try to look at that and see are there ways to streamline that. We're studying other states and what they've done with the hope that we will be able to present some solutions in the coming year. So we appreciate that feedback.
I'd also like to echo Dr. Thacker and going across state lines. We have a lot of people that go to Alabama that currently, and that tends to be pretty problematic right now.
Okay. Well, that they are, just to be clear, they are allowed to be part of the network and have been encouraged. We do have a number of people who are asking to comment, so if the member, Dr. Moffitt, yes.
Very, very quickly, Kathy Moffitt, I'm representing the Florida Association of Health Plans, and not to state the obvious, but I think there were a lot of people in the state of Florida that were worried about your entrusting this very fragile, very precious population of Floridians to the managed care industry, and I've said this before, but I want to congratulate you again on the process. I think the procurement was intense but very effective. I think the readiness review process was extremely thorough. It was very tough on the plans. It was very focused on the care. Throughout the implementation process, we met frequently, and you told us what to look out for. You shared the potential pitfalls with us. There was very good open dialogue. And now the complaint hub helps us in very real time address issues that come up. So I think all the stakeholders are working well together. Nothing's perfect, but I think we are very privileged and honored to be partnering with you on this, and we are very encouraged at how well this has gone off on behalf of our industry. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Moffitt. And I would agree that it's not perfect, and that is why we will continue to work on it. We've said the work really has just begun. So, okay, I have at least six folks who want to speak, so I will call them. Let me let you know who I'm calling now, and let me tell the next person so that they can be ready. And if you could come up, I think it would be helpful if you could come here to this side, and we can hand you a microphone. The first person is Emma Henderson, and then she'll be followed by Don LeBrec. So. Ms. Henderson?
Right. Okay. Good afternoon. I'm working with the Guardian and Ad Litem program, and my question and concern was when the changes were put into the changes were made last year, we got a consultation from ARCA. She came out and did a presentation of the changes. But the problem that we were seeing was that when the insurance, you had a certain number of days to switch over to another program. The problem was that a lot of our clients and our children in foster care didn't know that they had this time period, and it wasn't done within that time period. And when they went to for services, then there was a problem. They couldn't get services because there was a confusion in the insurance, what program they were under. And my question was, the complaints that were called in to ARCA here, it went into, I guess, a recording system, and a lot of the complaints were not addressed. Has that issue been looked at, or
I'm afraid I'm not sure. I don't think that we have a. Are you saying like a voicemail system for
when the changes were first made?
When individuals, as David mentioned, individuals were given a the address on their on record. They were sent a kind of a pre-notice saying changes are coming, mm-hmm. and then the packet that would tell them exactly what they needed to do, and then a reminder if they had not if they'd not made a choice within that time period, still giving them 30 days, and then they had 90 days afterwards to change a plan. In addition to that, we had the continuity of care provision so that if they went to a provider and didn't realize that through those notifications that they had a plan change, then they could still be seen by that provider and that provider could be paid. Yeah. But I'm afraid I'm not aware that there was perhaps voice messages left that for complaints, or maybe you could elaborate a little bit more on that.
Well, there was a number given that to call ARCA here. And if there were some problems with, you know, getting switched over or getting information on who the new insurance carrier was or what insurance program they were under now.
Okay.
And this was a court. Well, we were having meetings of our guardian volunteers. And this is what was some of the complaints that we had.
Okay. We appreciate that. We'll take a look at it. In terms of our choice counselor lines, we're not seeing any calls being blocked or that is not being able to be answered.
But this was when it was first presented last year.
Okay. We are not aware of any problems to that extent, but if there are specifics that you have, you please let us know through the complaint hub, and we've certainly addressed them.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you want to respond, Amy?
Hi, this is Amy Guinan again with Florida Legal Services. If I could just really quickly, Ms. Hernandez, or Henders, I'm guessing that you work with the guardian ad litem, and so most of the clients that you were talking about were in foster care, and could possibly, I know there was the question or there an issue about children enrolled in CMS, because and who are also in foster care being enrolled in the specialty plan. And this was a glitch, for I guess a lack of a better term, right at the very beginning of the implementation process. And I know I was working with the guardian ad litem program, and I believe maybe the number that she was referring to wasn't the ACA number, but the statewide Medicaid managed care hotline number to call to get information about enrollment. And it was my understanding that there was a lot of confusion with foster care advocates, foster care parents, and the CBCs in the CMS versus Sunshine Specialty HMO enrollment process, if that helps.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. Okay. Don LeBrec. And there you are. Hey. And then next will be Brandy Joyt. Okay. Thank you.
All right. My name is Don LeBrec. For those of you who don't know me, I have been the Director of Quality Improvement with Florida Sheriff's Youth Branches for 15 years. Okay, there we are. Does that sound better?
Yes, thank you.
Again, I want to be able to express to you, Ms. Kidder, and then the rest of the board, thank you for the opportunity to be able to be here and present. I want to be able to say that as part of the Medicaid community, we've been providing Medicaid services through the Florida Sheriff's Youth Ranches for over 15 years, which is about the extent of time that I've had an intimate level of contact with this agency and the delivery of services. Now, the services we have is more specifically related to the behavioral health overlay services that we've had that we've been certified through your organization for quite some time. As we know, the SMMA program had an early start last year as an early implementer because one of our programs was in Region 3. We knew it would be one of the initial implementers of this service. And so we rolled our sleeves up and dug into the work as fast and as hard as we could. We knew that this was going to be coming, that our first program would be up and running by May 1st in alignment with the target date for that first region. And we absorbed as much of the information as we could preliminarily to before the advent so that we could be as properly prepared as possible. Our we attended as many conferences as we could, as many online things as we could. We signed up for as much information as we could to try to keep ourselves as plugged in as we could. The start point came and went. We felt we pretty much understood the system as we knew it back then. And I'd like to be able to say to the rest, to you and the rest of the board, that it's been a cakewalk, but unfortunately it has not. It's been everything but that. We've been plagued by a number of problems, both large and small, some that we really didn't expect, and some others that were just simple but just frustratingly hard to solve. Some of the biggest problems we've had has been the level of communication that exists between us and AHCA, and the level of communication we have between the people we have contracted through to provide the services as well. As late as July, I was beginning to receive personal, calls from other directors from programs down south, asking about the SMMA programs. Apparently, some of them ranged everywhere from small details like how do you get an authorization for these kids, all the way to, well, what is simpatico and what kind of relationship do they have with us, and everything in between. We have reached a level of frustration to the point where now we're communicating now as a broader group, through Ken Bender's organization, Boys Town up here, and we're trying to discuss these issues as they come. I know that I believe you've had a meeting too with our executive heads over with the youth ranches over here in this agency as well. We want to be able to solve these issues, but some of the problems that we have, frankly, are we feel like when we send out a communicate or for a request for help, we hear a lot of crickets in the field waiting for a response. We didn't really know until there was a complaint line until about August, really, and that was really kind of communicated back from one of our meetings with your executive heads here. Once we knew that, we ended up putting that in immediately. The response we got was more than a week later. We are still waiting for resolution to that particular problem anyway. So it's still an ongoing issue right now. I don't know if that's the particular case with the complaint line at this point right now, if it was a specific issue just related to our circumstance, but I would be suspect to believe that, these things are getting resolved or people are getting contacted within that 24-hour time limit that you say it is. As far as current revenues are concerned.
And Mr. LeBrecht, if I could ask you to perhaps summarize your comments, because we are coming.
One more point I'm going to make, too, is roughly along the budget. At this point right now, from the beginning of the SMMA program, when we first signed on to roughly the end of August, current revenues that we billed were over $191,000. We have still a balance due of over $121,000. So in terms of the actual resolution of benefits and fees, we're still waiting for an awful lot of payment. I look forward to trying to help solve these problems with Medicaid and its associated carriers. We don't want to dismiss the issue. It's one that I know that's going to be around. That's going to be continuing forward from this point forward. But we do need to have a lot more communication and resolution with some of the issues, and on a more timely basis than what we've currently been experiencing. I'm open to any questions, of course.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I had a quick question then. Do you have any particular region that's more of an issue for you folks? Or
they extend through all. We're based in two regions, basically. We're in Region 3. We're also, I believe, in Region 7, I think. 6, I'm sorry. But the issues have been equally diverse and specific and non-specific to any particular region. It seems to be, I come into the office every morning and find out, well, what is the new problem today? I have a sheaf of EOBs that sit on my desk right now. They're waiting for resolution.
So if someone from ACA...
Dr. Thacker, can I... I'm sorry. Can you please send him a microphone? Thank you. And I'm going to ask, too, if we can kind of conclude. So we have about 8 people who are waiting to make comments. We are coming close to the end of our slated time, so we're checking to see, because this was legally noticed as 1 hour, and we have another legally noticed meeting, so we're checking to see what our next steps are. But if we could bring this portion to close, sure. Please go ahead
so,
and talk about that.
Do you have or can you assign someone specific with your organization to work with someone specific through ACA? I mean, are you structured that way?
Sure.
That could disseminate through your, you know, both regions there and all your folks.
Sure. That person is mainly me.
And we encourage everybody to continue putting their issues into the hub. We, in the beginning, were able to contact everybody within 24 hours. We do triage the issues based on urgency. We are able to get back to people usually between 2 to 3 days now.
So. Well, unfortunately, I wish that was my experience.
Okay. So, thank you. I'm going to take one more comment. Ms. Randy Goit. Oh, I'm sorry. She is on the phone, so let me open up the phone. After her comments, because this was legally noticed, we're going to conclude this portion and do the portion that relates of the meeting that relates to the amendment to the waiver. What we will be able to do then is come back to this portion of it and hear the rest of the comments. So.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
And just so you know, in regards to legal notice, you just sent out an email saying that this meeting is starting at 2:30. Your guys' memo, it just sent out, just so you know.
Yes,
but my comment and question is, to make this quick,
I'm sorry, is this really? Miss Brandy Goit?
Yes, this is Brandy.
Okay, thank you.
Brandy Goit. And my question is, to make this very quickly, he stated during his webinar presentation that people who are dually enrolled do not have to choose an MMA plan. Is this true? Like Medicare, Medicaid recipients, do they have to choose an MMA plan?
Yes. For the most part, people who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid do need to choose a managed medical assistance plan. There are people who are enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan who will be choosing this fall for an enrollment date in January. And we did that to sync up the time periods with Medicare open enrollment, so they would have the opportunity to choose the same plan for Medicare and Medicaid if that's available in their region. Thank you.
So do the people then, second question based on what you just said, during Medicare open enrollment, do the dual eligibles have the option of changing their MMA plan during Medicare open enrollment, or do they have to wait until the Medicaid open enrollment?
Those individuals who are in, as I mentioned, in Medicare Advantage plans, those are Medicare managed care plans, would have their open enrollment coincide. For others, it would be during their open enrollment period, which is individualized depending on when you came into the program or when your region went live, if you're already in Medicaid at the time that the program opened up.
Okay, so it would be the Medicaid open enrollment date.
Yes.
Okay. And that was, I think, and the next question was, is if with getting in line with the waivers, okay, being part of person-centered planning as part of the waiver and also having patient choice being a part of it, how is basically forcing them to choose not violating that?
I'm sorry, and are you talking about dual eligibles needing to be enrolled in a managed medical assistance plan?
Yes.
I'm sorry, if others on the phone could put their phone on mute, we are hearing some background noise. The waiver does specify that individuals who are dually eligible are people who are mandatory for enrollment unless they have some other are in another category that makes them either exempt or voluntary. And that is an approvable under an 1115 waiver and is approved part of ours. They do have a choice of providers in all areas of managed care plans. In addition to that, have a choice of any of the providers in the plans network.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to put this back on.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Okay. Again, I'm sorry that we ran out of time for this portion of it, but we will circle back on this as Ms. And I apologize, Ms. Brandy, because I can't say her last name. Notice that we do have another public meeting that's noticed to start at this time, which is to talk about the amendment to the waiver. So I'm going to turn it over to Siobhan Harris to briefly introduce that. We will take comments on that, and then we will come back to the comments from this portion.
Thank you, Beth. So in the interest of time, you should... Okay, better? Okay. In the interest of time, I will quickly go through the presentation that you should have in your packets. It is entitled Amendment Request for Florida's 1115 Managed Medical Assistance Waiver. On slide two, we present a timeline of the federal waiver authorization process, which David Rogers already briefed you on, so I will quickly go past this particular slide. Just to say that we are in a 3-year waiver extension cycle from 2014 to 2017, and we are going through the public notice process, engaging stakeholders as we embark on an amendment to the current waiver cycle. Slide 3 provides basic information on the types of items that we would need federal approval for if we wanted to amend the 1115 waiver. So in this particular case, we are going to be amending some of the eligibility requirements. So you can see on this slide that that's one of the areas that we would require federal approval from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Slide 4, I highlight some of the transparency requirements that are codified in federal law and in rule around the public notice process. So the agency has to publish certain information on our website around what we are amending, as well as give the public 30 days to provide input into that process. So our public notice document was published on our website, and the link is available in your PowerPoint presentation packet. The public comment period is open from September 17th through October 14th. This is one of the public forums that we will be discussing the particular amendment, and I'll talk about the second forum later in this presentation. And I will come back to slide 4 to present the email and address information if you would like to submit written comments. So now let's get into the meat of it. So the agency is seeking federal authority to amend our 1115 waiver to allow certain populations who were previously excluded from the MMA program to voluntarily enroll in the program. One of those populations includes children who are receiving services through a prescribed pediatric extended care center. The acronym for that is PPEC. I'll be using that acronym throughout my presentation. So if a child was receiving services in a PPEC center, they previously couldn't enroll in the MMA program, and so this amendment per changes in the Florida law will allow that population to voluntarily choose to enroll in the MMA program. In addition, the Florida legislature allowed for individuals residing in a group home licensed under Section 393.067 Florida statutes to also voluntarily choose to enroll in the MMA program. That population, unless previously exempt in statute, would have had to enroll in the MMA program and would not have had a choice other than to receive their services through a managed care plan. Slide 6 just goes through some of the objectives of the amendment. Again, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through that. I will just state that by allowing this population to voluntarily choose to enroll in the MMA program, they have the opportunity to benefit from the expanded benefits offered by the plan, take advantage of the enhanced care coordination and integrated care model that is offered through our new managed care model and delivery system. On slide 7, we identify the public meetings that are scheduled. So again, today's MCAC meeting is one of the public meetings that we have scheduled to discuss this change. We also have another meeting in Tampa at the Medicaid area office scheduled for September 29th from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock p.m. If you are in that area and would like to come face-to-face and meet with ACA to discuss this change, that will be your opportunity. However, going back to slide 4, you do not have to physically attend one of the public meetings in order to provide comments to ACA. You can submit written comments via email to floridamedicaidwaivers@aca.myflorida.com. And if I said that too fast, not to worry, the information is in your packet. Or you can mail comments to 1115 MMA Waiver Amendment Request, Office of the Deputy Secretary for Medicaid, Agency for Healthcare Administration, 2727 Mahan Drive, mail stop number 8, Tallahassee, Florida, 32308. Again, I went through that fairly quickly because I know we have comments from the public on our previous agenda item, but I'm going to open up the floor now to anyone who has comments on this specific amendment that the agency will be submitting to the Federal Centers for Medicaid, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We'll address any comments now, and then, as Beth said, we'll go back to any comments that we received previously.
So for the folks on the phone, let me remind you what the email address is. If you would like to be recognized to speak on this amendment, it's flmedicaidwaivers@aca.myflorida.com. If you're in the room, if you could put a card in with the folks at the table over here, they'll bring them over to me. And then also, again, we're taking comments on this amendment only. And after that, we'll open it up. We had 6 people who were not unable to speak during the last period. So I think that we can stay within our allotted time if each of you will take no more than 5 minutes on your comments. So we'll do that after this session ends. And then we've gotten a number of comments in from folks wondering about these presentations and where they can get them. They will be posted on our website immediately following the meeting, at the conclusion of the meeting today. Well, maybe not immediately. They'll be posted following. By tomorrow, they'll be up. So with that, Dr. Thacker, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I would be referring back to slide 6, and this is in regard, of course, to the amendment and the objectives. And so I'm particularly interested in the first paragraph where we're asking to allow residents of group home facilities to select an MMA plan and take advantage of the higher standards. And so what I'm sure what's inherent in that statement, which I would agree with, is the what is our goal? And our goal should be, of course, equality and outcomes, but also, once again, access. And that's, you know, that's a big theme of mine and everyone else's, I'm sure. We want to control cost as well. And so some more of the grittier details in that would be, does this also imply a fee-for-service type of payment plan? How this might affect the primary care of the patient, and in particular the assignment of that patient's care to a primary care doc. So, for instance, many, many, if not almost all folks in a group home situation will either be cared for by a medical director that's potentially been hired or has volunteered to be the primary care physician for most, if not all, of those patients in a group home setting. So how may that affect or not affect, first of all, their primary care doctor and the responsibility? So how are those patients affected? I want you to consider that sometimes a primary care physician will agree to take care of all of the residents, or at least most of the residents in a group home setting. If you take away most of those folks, then you take away that visiting physician to that group home, because now it's not feasible. Sometimes they have to travel, or they've blocked out time in their daily office or whatever. So in order for that to work for most docs, there's got to be enough need, enough volume per se. Okay. Many folks, the other things to consider is many folks in a group home, it's not feasible for them to be transported to a doctor's office. That also adds cost to somebody, whether it's the home or the individual or the particular plan. But somebody's got to provide for that, not to mention the additional liability, and not to mention that most if not all of these clients will need a supervising attendant person. So we have to take that into account. In terms of quality of care and outcomes, how might this affect them in terms of their ability to obtain dental care? How does this affect them in terms of their equipment that's required, whether it's oxygen provided through a particular company or something as simple as a shower chair? Other services such as podiatry and psychiatry, which oftentimes are also visitations by that particular specialist that will come to the facility. And so if you limit their, if you limit the numbers, then you basically will limit the ability of physicians to travel to that group homes, essentially making house calls. You are not going to get a physician unless they live next door or unless they're coming to see grandma anyway, that they're going to make a house call for one patient. It's not going to happen. And so is it what we want? And this would go under the category of unintended consequences. If we've got folks in the group home that are being cared for and have access because access is being brought to them, will there be an unintended consequence that now you've got 10 to 30 patients or whatever number now going in 30 different directions at different times, and the the difficulty in coordinating all of that? So I think we have to take those types of things into consideration. I don't know that you have specific answers for all that, and I don't necessarily expect that, but I would feel a lot more comfortable that someone's thought of those things and is addressing them and being proactive. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Gunner.
Hello. Just a real quick question relating to the children receiving the PPEC services. Do we have an idea of how many children that will impact? And also, what's happening to them now while we wait to get the waiver approved? Have they been able to remain in CMS or their health plan?
So the estimate of children impacted, that's about 1,600 children who are receiving services through a PPEC center. To ensure continuity of care, yes, we have allowed them to remain in CMS if they have contacted us and requested that.
Carla, do...
Just a very quick question. I'm not a lawyer. The extension of the waiver has already been granted. That's a done deal. And CMS will hold the amendment request completely separate from the extension considerations, right? They won't go back to that because of the amendment request, right?
Correct. They're separate.
Did we have anyone emailing in or commenting from within the group here? Okay. If you could come up, Mr. Taylor, and we'll just ask that you put in a card so that we can record your name.
Chris Snow, Alliance of Florida PPACs. Just in looking at the language in the administrative review, which may not be the complete language, it talks about, obviously, the change in the exemption from exclusion to voluntary. I don't see mention that the PPAC service is still totally exempt and is totally through fee-for-service. So I don't know. I'm not a waiver expert. I don't know if that has to be in there. But I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Yes. I believe it is actually clarified that way in the language in the waiver. So thank you for pointing that out. Yes, just so to clarify for everybody else, even though the children could elect to, or their families could elect for the child to be served by a managed care plan, the PPAC service would remain a fee-for-service service. That is per the statute. Thank you. Yes,
this is Stan Whitaker with the Florida Association of Nurse Practitioners. Excuse me. One of the issues that we've run up that's similar to that is that when we have a group home or a group of patients that are in a setting, that a lot of times you get several plans that are available within that home, and we're seeing a lot of those patients getting incentivized to stay underneath one plan because it's so problematic, much like Dr. Thacker mentioned.
And when you say incentivized, can you be a little more specific about that?
Just encouraged to all go with one plan.
Okay. And so individuals have choice of which providers serve them and which plan they're in.
We understand, but I'm just relaying the concerns and the feedback I'm getting back from my group.
I would want, if you all are seeing something that you think might be inappropriate for individuals, either being coerced, these are individuals in vulnerable situations who may be easily influenced by the people, the home where they live. If you see there's anything inappropriate, if you could please let us know. The plans cannot influence over who chooses which plan, or they're very severe.
It's not the plans.
Marketing. I'm sorry?
It's not the plans.
Not the plans. Okay.
It's administration.
Okay. So, again, if there's anything inappropriate.
I just want to clarify that it's not the plans that are doing that.
Okay. Well, good. That's good. But we would want to know if you feel that there's some kind of inappropriate influence going on. I am not a licensure expert for DD Group for group homes, but we certainly could get that to the right people to look at.
I wanted to follow up with that, Dr. Thacker, again, and that dovetails into what I was speaking about earlier, in that for a provider, especially one that makes the call, but also for the administrator of that particular group home, it makes sense for them that the more people in their facility that sign up with the same plan, it's in their best interest because it's so much easier to administer. And so I echo what Stan said in that I don't think it's the plans doing anything coercive. I think it's the folks that have to coordinate and do the paperwork, and I think it's human nature in the sense that if you consider all of the plans to be very similar and there's not a dramatic difference, then, boy, it would be a lot easier if everybody's on the same plan at that facility, and then you can get everything coordinated. The more plans, and this is not particularly a problem here in this region, as I said, there's two plans. But some, as you see on the spreadsheet, multiple plans, if you have a substantial size group home, you could have one or two or 10 people and 6 different plans. Very much more difficult to coordinate services. Thank you.
I have 2 comments, so I will get to those in a second. Just to reiterate to everybody that these will be voluntary choices for these 2 groups. This is adding groups who were previously either excluded from being able to choose managed care or who were, in the case of group homes, somewhat undefined. So it makes it clear that they can stay in fee-for-service or they can choose a managed care plan. We did have a question from another Medical Care Advisory Committee member who is on the phone, Ms. Pierce, and who is asking whether people with developmental disabilities will be required to choose a plan or whether they can stay on their Medicaid and Medicare as it stands. So Medicare, again, is not impacted in any way by the changes in Medicaid. So there would be no changes to Medicare, and people with developmental disabilities remain voluntary for managed care. That is, they can choose to be in managed care plan or they can choose not to, and that does not change with this amendment. Right. If they are either on the waiver or if they are on the developmental disabilities waiver or if they are waiting for DD waiver services. Interesting feedback. Okay. And then the second one is from Susan Rodriguez, who is she in the room or is this someone on the phone? I will open the lines for Ms. Rodriguez.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Ms. Rodriguez, can you go ahead?
Yes, I am here.
Thank you. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, during a prior ACA webinar, we were informed that PPAC consumers were in the voluntary status, and when I received the alert for the amendment, it states that it sounded like it was trying to be considered to do that. Can you confirm if they're currently in voluntary status, or is that in the near future?
Individuals who are in PPAC are currently able to choose a managed care plan while we go forward with the federal authority.
Okay. And those payments, if they do choose an MMA program, are paid Medicaid fee-for-service?
The PPAC services remain fee-for-service, yes.
Oh, thank you so much for that clarification.
Thank you.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Do we have any more comments that have come in?
Okay. I had a follow-up question. I'm sorry. But do we know about fee-for-service in regards to the MMA plans?
So the PPAC service will remain paid fee-for-service regardless of whether the person is in an MMA plan or not in an MMA plan. Was that your question, Dr. Thacker?
And that's for pediatric. And so isn't there a subset of adults that would potentially be in a group home, or is it all pediatric?
So there really are 2 separate populations. The prescribed pediatric extended care is only for children, and I believe it's only, are they up to 21? Mm-hmm. So it is available up to age 21, although the children tend to be younger than that in those settings. The group home setting is not an age-limited category, so they are 2 separate groups.
Okay, so if we talk about group homes then, in regards to the waiver that we're asking for, does that become, a fee-for-service type of situation?
Medicaid does not generally pay for the services of a group home unless they are being paid through the developmental disabilities waiver, in which case that is a fee-for-service waiver and that will remain fee-for-service. There are services that are brought into the group home, such as you mentioned, the physician services, specialty services. You might have home health coming into that group home. And again, if those are services that are covered under the managed medical assistance plan, then that will be covered by the plan through a capitated arrangement.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Other questions or comments on the proposed amendment? As Siobhan mentioned, we are in an open public comment period on this. There are opportunities to comment in writing through mail, through email, and also through our public, other public meetings we'll be having later this month in Tampa. So I will bring this portion to a conclusion. I was going to go ahead and go straight back to the public comments, but Mr. Nathan Lewis is here from the Department of Children and Families, and he had an update on some eligibility-related issues, and so I wanted to go ahead and give him that opportunity to go ahead and make those comments. And if we could get your microphone, Nathan, and that'll need to be turned on.
Green is good, right? Good afternoon. I appreciate you squeezing me in. As Beth mentioned, my name is Nathan Lewis. I'm with the Department of Children and Families. I've never had that issue before. I'm with the Department of Children and Families Economic Self-Sufficiency Program Office, and we do the, among other things, Medicaid eligibility determinations for Florida. And we wanted to have an opportunity to come to the Advisory Council primarily because we know that there are going to be representatives from our managed care partners here. Surprise. And we are looking to reach out with to them for some assistance in, and we'll be doing this through ACA, but we wanted to reach out to them for some assistance in implementing a change that's coming in mid-November. I'm only going to talk about one specific change, but as I'm sure all of you know, we implemented the Florida Health the Affordable Health Care requirements for the family populations. You'll hear people talk to them about the MAGI Medicaid populations, but it's easier to think of them as children and pregnant women and caretakers, that population, not the age blind and disabled. We rolled that out in December, and we've been working on the second phase of our rollout. And the part that I wanted to talk to y'all about today was the changes in how annual renewals are done. And that's critical to not only us, to the agency, but also to all of the managed care associations that we have, because we all have a vested interest in making sure that at renewal people continue to maintain their eligibility. They don't roll off for some administrative reason. The Affordable Health Care Act, as it relates to renewals, required us to do two things. Both of those we'll be doing in November. The first of which is what I'll kind of refer to as an administrative renewal. We're going to use the electronic, I should have thought to pass that out in advance. Shoot that way, I appreciate it. What I'm circulating is a flow chart of how renewals will take place. And just a cheat sheet that we've provided to ACA to give to, I think you call it your all providers call, so that information should be on the street already. So what we're going to do roughly 45 days in advance of somebody's eligibility coming due, we will tap our federal data sources and look to see whether the information that's contained at what our federal partners refer to as the hub match what we already know about the customer in terms of citizenship and identity. That type of thing shouldn't change, but more importantly, things like Social Security income, and we'll be tapping our own state sources for earnings. If the information that comes across through these sources matches what we already know about the customer, and there is nothing else that would raise a flag, we're going to be able to administratively renew these individuals for another 12 months. In other words, they will not have to go through the physical renewal process with us. They will get a letter from the department that says, we've evaluated your situation. You continue to be eligible. You need to we'll go through this again in 12 months. For that population, if we were handling them in essentially a no-touch, staff won't have to work those cases. And it will they'll generally be notified in advance of the month that they actually would have been scheduled to have their review done anyway. So they'll be done in advance. There's going to be a population that either we don't have data sources to match from, or the information that we have in our existing case record is inconsistent with the match that we're receiving. In those cases, we will handle essentially the way that we handle a renewal today, which is, you know, we'll send them a letter, and the letter will say it's time for your renewal and go online, at least in most cases, go online. We're developing a pre-populated renewal form online. So everything that I know about the recipient will be there, and we're asking to look at it, make sure that it's still accurate. If it's not accurate, report a change. We'll follow up on it. Presuming everything happens the way that it should, then at that point we will be able to renew the Medicaid for another 12 months. Now, we know historically there are going to be people that either don't comply with, and they don't, simply don't do the renewal, or they don't return verifications associated with that renewal. And in those cases, their Medicaid will be terminated, which brings us to the second significant change and the second thing that we're going to be reaching out to the managed care partners to try to communicate to our mutual customers. The Affordable Health Care Act requires the state to give an individual 90 days after their benefits have been terminated to come back in and submit their renewal. So if somebody has lost their eligibility because they failed to comply, they either didn't do the renewal period, or they failed to provide the verifications that we require associated with that renewal, they'll be able to go to their online account, and from that online account, they'll be able to click a button that says renew. Historically, we've already have an electronic renewal process, but today, until November 10th, 11th, that button goes away. The renewal button goes away as soon as the person's case gets closed. After November the 11th, that link will stay active for 90 days. So an individual who, for example, lost their eligibility at the end of November because they failed to comply with either the renewal or the verification requirements would be able to come and find that link active for December, January, February, for 90 days, and begin the renewal process. They don't have to submit a new application. It'll bring information that we already know about them. They'll essentially be able to start where they left off, presuming that they started it at all. These two things, the very front-end piece, the administrative renewal, and the back-end piece, the 90-day, we really want to make sure that we're communicating not only with ACA, but with our own network of community partners, but also with the managed care organizations, because we want to make sure that this message gets out. We want to make sure that that our mutual customers know you don't have to, and I know that they call your customer service lines the same as they call my customer service lines. I know that they send emails, they communicate with y'all the same way that they communicate with us. And so we want to make sure that y'all have the message to give to these to folks that says, you know, if you were closed specifically for a renewal-related purpose reason, then all you've got to do is go back into your account and pick up where you left off. So so for the folks at the table, like I said, you got a flow chart, which I went through it kind of quickly because I'm trying to get you back on schedule. But there's a flow chart that kind of walks through the process, and this is a high-level description. One of the things that we've talked to the agency about is providing information, some kind of scripted information that you might be able to provide to your call center agents that says somebody calls and says my Medicaid was closed, what do I do, so that you have answers, you know where to direct them. We know that many of the organizations have newsletters or communications that you do with recipients, and so we're working on creating some language that could be, if you chose to, you could include it in newsletter type documents that you send out. And I know that historically we have worked with some of the MCOs to reach out to customers before they actually come due for a renewal, kind of a heads up. You know, one of the things that we've discovered at our end is that sometimes folks get confused about Medicaid and they don't, and we want to make sure that confusion is mitigated to the degree possible. So we want to make sure that folks know that when you receive a letter from DCF telling you that it's time to renew your Medicaid, it's the same thing as renewing your, you know, your eligibility in your managed care group. And I know I'm oversimplifying it, but so we want to reach out. So we're going to be working with ACA to provide some language. And if there's anybody, particularly from the managed care organization, that would like to get in touch with me, you can, I'll leave some cards with Beth. I have a 3 o'clock that I need to get to as well, but I'll leave some cards with Beth if you want to reach back out to me about, you know, how we can work cooperatively on messaging, because as we roll this out, we think it's very beneficial for the recipients. We know that some of them, you know, we're not even going to have to see them at renewal. That's a plus for everybody. And we know that we're going to have a large number of people. Historically, we have a large number of people that don't do their renewals, and we want to make sure that renewal process under ACA is as smooth as possible. So if there's any specific questions, Beth, you want me to take them.
So, Nathan, there are other stakeholders here who see recipients, so they're either their patients. Would they also be able to perhaps reach out to you all and get information for their newsletters or information that they could give to the patients if they're eligibility is expired? So if this is something that you're interested in, this really is a positive, whatever we can do to make it easier to stay in Medicaid once someone has become eligible. So we really do want to spread the word on this and get people used to, if at all possible, checking online first. It's the fastest and most efficient way for them to get renewed. And all their old information will be out there. You know how much easier it is when a form is kind of pre-populated for you and you're just checking to make sure everything's okay rather than have to go in and re-enter everything. So I hope that the rest of y'all will also consider helping us spread the word about this development. DCF is putting together a very nice kind of information campaign about this. And if you have a forum that you would like to get the information out in, I'm sure that Robin on their staff would work with you to get the right kind of size or formatting that you would need to get this information out. So I hope you'll consider that. If you're not sure, ask us and we'll get you in touch with the right folks at DCF. So questions for Nathan on this? We'll leave. We can perhaps, let's see, we'll try to think about the best way to put this out. If folks maybe if we could start, Kim, if they're on the side, if we could maybe start a list of people who would be interested in knowing how to do this, and you could put leave your card, and then we can get that to the folks at DCF to reach out to you. That'd probably be the easiest way to do this. So Kim over here on the side table will start a list or a pile for cards on that. Okay. Thank you, Nathan. I appreciate that. Okay, so we're learning as we do this, so thank you for bearing with us. This is, I don't think we've ever tried to do quite so many public meetings in one space. So I'm going to go back one step and finish out one comment that came in before the end of the period on the amendment. This is from Ms. Deborah Linton with ARC.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Deborah, are you on the line?
I'm on the line. I was just wondering, I know that individuals with developmental disabilities were a voluntary group anyway. Were the people in the licensed residential facilities excluded in the previous waiver? Because I can't figure out why we have to do an amendment to make them voluntary.
You're right, Deborah, that the people with developmental disabilities who were either on the waiver or on the waiting list for the waiver were an excluded population. The specific reason that we're doing this is to make clear that we're in compliance with the law. Which specifically calls out this group. There is a possibility, although slim, that you could have somebody in a group home that is on Medicaid but is not on the waiver or on the waiting list for the waiver. And so we want to make it clear that that group is a voluntary population as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true. I understand that now. And I just want to say one of the previous speakers talked about medical directors with group homes and doctors, and for the most part, the people in the residential facilities do have a choice of doctors in the community. I don't have any facilities that have medical directors, doctors who come to the homes, but that's always going to be a concern, is that they have freedom of choice in the community, and if they do enroll in MMA, we would hope they still have a rich environment from which to choose. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Linton.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Sorry, that's really loud. Okay, so we are going to go back. We had six individuals who did not get to finish the comments during the first period where we were talking about the managed care waiver and kind of debriefing after the first year of its operation or the first year that the waiver was live. And so I will go ahead. I ask in the interest of time that we limit our that we ask that comments be limited to no more than 5 minutes each, and that will allow us to get to the final part of our meeting today, which is the quality strategy, and then to break out into the subgroups that will be discussing that in more detail. So as I did before, the first person up will be Ms. Renee Jenkins, and then after that will be Dr. Louis St. Petri. Okay, so I will, Ms. Jenkins is on the phone.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Okay, Ms. Jenkins, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm on the line, and my comment is related to the general comments about the MMA implementation. It's not specific to the waiver. Is that okay?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Okay, again, my name is Renee Jenkins. I'm with the Florida Department of Health. I'm in the Early Step State Office here in Tallahassee. And Early Step serves infants and toddlers from birth to 36 months of age who have developmental delays or disabilities. And some of the children in Early Steps, not a large number, are in the CMS network plan, but most of them are not. They're in other plans. And I wanted to share some issues that we've been hearing from providers serving our population about the impact of the MMA. First is related to network adequacy. Our providers, primarily occupational, physical, and speech and language pathologists, therapists, report that there's a closed or a limited access to enroll in the managed care networks. They're reporting that providers who are in network have limited to no experience serving the birth to three population. And they also report that providers who apply are told that there'll be a long wait on their application. And those who are in network, they're finding, also have often a clinic-based service delivery and are not able to serve our population in home and community settings. One other issue that we've heard is related to service authorizations. We're hearing that for therapy, service authorizations are often difficult to obtain, taking a long time to acquire an authorization, and when they are authorized, often the level of service is not comparable to what our providers and our teams have determined necessary for the child through our individualized family support plan process. So there's some need to do a request for reconsideration, and those are often taken a long time and often denied. So that's just sort of in a nutshell. And we have been communicating with our providers to use the complaint hub, and hopefully they're doing that. But I just wanted to take this opportunity to share what we've been hearing from them.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jenkins, and I appreciate that you're encouraging them to put the specifics in. I know sometimes providers do not want to be identified, and they can actually put things anonymously into the complaint, but we still want to know, and it is actually helpful to know specifics about which plan, which area you're in, and so forth, so that we can target in on any kind of issue areas. There are standards for how long it takes to get a prior authorization. They're in contract. We take those very seriously, as we do enforcing all the provisions of our handbook. So, for example, that therapy services be able to be provided in the natural environment. So we would want to know about those specifics. It helps us greatly in our compliance efforts to be able to hone in quickly on problem areas. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. St. Petri, if you would come on up. The next
presentation mode is now enabled.
The next. Oh, absolutely. Sure. And the next person after Dr. St. Petri will be Suzanne Stevens.
I'm Louis St. Petri, and I'm a pediatric cardiologist here in Tallahassee, and I'm the executive vice president of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and thank you for the opportunity to address you. I'm afraid that I don't have great praise for the MMA rollout, at least from pediatricians and parents of children trying to get care. There was really a lot of problems related to children with special health care needs, children in the foster care system, and as the last speaker, children in early steps. We're in Tallahassee, and the MMA rollout was first here. And when parents went to the choice counseling line, Children's Medical Services was not an option. That's totally unacceptable. And I wrote to Secretary Dudek in January anticipating problems, and we were never a stakeholder with whom ACA met regarding that issue. And even today, now that rollout is, quote, complete, we still have a lot of problems with kids in foster care whose families and the CBCs wanted them to stay in CMS, yet they got put in Sunshine regardless, and getting them out of Sunshine became very difficult. As you know, kids who are out of home, and that is they're not within their parents' home in the dependency system, the community-based care organizations are responsible for choosing a provider under choice, as has been discussed here today. Yet when the CBCs called the choice counselors, CMS is not an option. It took at least 2 months into the MMA rollout before CMS became an option, and we still have kids who whose parents and or whose CBCs or guardians want them in CMS, but it's very difficult to get them into CMS. The early steps problems, they're even much worse than what the lady said. Early steps providers find that the third-party intermediary, Med3000, doesn't pay some claims, is not timely in paying other claims, overpays some claims, and underpays other claims. And sorting all that out for Early Steps, which has limited dollars, has become a real nightmare. They also have limited staff for doing that.
And Dr. St. Peter, when you say Med3000, are you referring to CMS's third-party administrator?
Early Steps deals through Med3000. Right.
Okay. That is the subcontracted third-party administrator for the CMS network.
That's correct.
Okay.
Secondly, provider panels within the MMA plans are often inadequate, particularly as they relate to children. The Early Steps commenter earlier spoke to that, and it's it also relates to other kids' programs. We found that ACA would approve an MMA plan that didn't have any providers to whom a pediatrician would ever send a kid, and yet those plans were considered adequate. And, for example, Sunshine, which is the statewide MMA for children in the dependency system, we still don't have adequate panels here in Tallahassee. And as a result, primary care providers are unwilling to sign up for those plans because they don't know where they're going to send kids who have X problem, Y problem, Z problem. I hear this from other parts of the state as well. It is not limited to Leon County or this region of the state. Thirdly, access to children's dental care has deteriorated immensely under the MMA plans. It's much more difficult to get children into dental care. It was bad before. It is certainly not better. And I'd like to go back and emphasize the choice counseling issues related to CMS and to foster kids. Choice counseling is a subcontractor of ACA. And quite honestly, I really don't understand why choice counseling wasn't instructed what to do with CMS kids early in the rollout. One other item, there was a long delay before ACA sent the two integrated care networks who handle children's medical services under the MMA. There was a long delay before they had a contract. We were well into the MMA rollout in this part of the state before they even had a contract, and quite frankly, up to 2 months before CMS rolled out as an MMA in August, there was a lot of question as to whether there actually would be a CMS MMA program because of the contract issues. Those are my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Dr. St. Peter, I would just ask that if any specific issues, please keep sending them through the hub. That is our best source of information for specifics. Thank you. Okay. Next is Suzanne Stevens, and is this? Thank you. Is that, oh, there you are. I'm so sorry. I didn't see you coming out. Next up will be Patty McWhorter. Go ahead, Ms. Stevens. Sign your stuff, Dr. St. Dimitri.
That's okay. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Suzanne Stevens, and I'm specifically addressing two concerns regarding the rollout with HIV and AIDS. I first want to acknowledge that I can't imagine how difficult this rollout is, and many of you made comments about how well you guys have been doing, and I would certainly reiterate under the circumstances that you're probably doing the best you can with such a large program. I will tell you, Melanie Brown-Wifter has been amazing for the HIV and AIDS population and has participated in a number of our advocacy calls to get the information out statewide, so we really appreciate that, Melanie. Two of the comments I just wanted to make were both regarding, I've received a lot of calls from our doctors about the pre-authorization for the HIV/AIDS medications and having to do it every 6 months and the amount of time that that takes for them. And what a burden that is for both them and the patients. If you're not aware, anybody going without medication for a day, for a dose, when it comes to HIV and AIDS medications is huge. So this could delay medications and cause some significant life issues. The second part is I recently learned that one of our pharmacies, mail order pharmacies that is statewide, was removed from one of the specialty plans without a notice, or not a notice that we were aware of. So patients are trying to be transitioned to other pharmacies. We obviously have a population that has no phones or is difficult to get a hold of. And I wasn't sure if a plan decides to get rid of a pharmacy, is there a 30 or 60 or 90 day process so that transition can occur without a patient potentially losing their medication, since it's hard to get a hold of some of our patients. And again, I go back to taking the medications as just a critical piece.
I know that we have that provision for certain providers, but I do not know if it's true for pharmacies, so we'll have to check on this database.
Yeah,
it off top of his head.
Let me actually, if you would mind.
I'll give you my information so that you can
do that,
because
there's
yeah.
a difference in for cause terminations versus not for cause. That.
Okay, I appreciate that, and I'll get with you before leave. Thank you. That was all.
Thank you. Next is Patty McWhorter. And is Patty on the phone?
Okay.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Ms. McWhorter, are you on the line?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I'm calling in today. I'm representing the Florida Association of Healthy Start Coalitions and also the Healthy Start Mom Care Network. Thank you, Ms. Kidder, for this opportunity to make these comments. This pertains to the first agenda item. In our Healthy Start and Mom Care programs, we provide prenatal and infant health care coordination and support services to prevent poor birth outcomes. And we've done so for 13 years with the waiver portion of our program. The Florida Association of Healthy Start Coalitions is working now to capture unintended consequences of the implementation of MMA and of Medicaid reform. And we've identified challenges related to the unwillingness of providers to accept patients into care before the client's managed care plan affiliation is in effect. And rather than bill for service directly to Medicaid or fee-for-service to Medicaid in the industry. So since we serve prenatal population, this impacts not only entry into care date for our clients in general, but can have a significant consequence for highest-risk clients. Another reported issue has been the increased lack of access into substance treatment programs during pregnancy for women enrolled in Medicaid. And this obviously impacts the health of the mother and places the unborn child at risk both before and after the birth. We've also experienced problems in the operation side of making sure our clients receive services and that our service providers are paid for those services. In the transition from the 1915B waiver to the 1115 waiver, we're having problems with access to the ACA client files and the data exchange that's necessary for our administrative services organization to ensure waiver services. So we're at the point right now where it may impact and hold up client services. So we need added guidance for that and overcoming that problem. We also have an observation that it might be helpful for a client liaison or an ombudsman to be accessible for the client once the client is in a managed care plan. And then I have one question, and that is, after June 30th of 2017, what are the plans for the waiver and waiver services?
Before I answer that, if I could ask everyone on the line to please put their phone on mute. We're getting a lot of background noise, conversations and paper shuffling. So the plans beyond that, we will plan to, as long as our... I'm going to ask everyone on the phone to please check that you are on mute. Okay, I'm going to, Ms. McWhorter, I'm going to put you on, everybody back on mute so we can, you can hear my answer, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Okay. So beyond 2017, if the legislation remains as it is, which is to mandate a managed care model, as we have now, then we will be seeking a renewal of the waiver under whatever terms of the program are in effect in our legislation at that time. Okay. The next person to speak is Greg Mello from Florida Chain. He is also, I believe, on the line. And after that will be Casey Stoudemire, who I believe is here in the audience. So let me unmute so Mr. Mello can speak.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Okay. Mr. Mello, are you on the line?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you very much. This is Greg Mello. I'm with Florida Chain, and we are advocates for and with Medicaid recipients. I just wanted to offer some brief comments. And we have said and we continue to say that the agency has done a good job with communicating and organizing during the rollout and addressing many of the prior concerns with the Medicaid reform pilot, particularly around stakeholder education, recipient transition, and plan review, and more and more as the rollout progressed. I mean, we think the four-month rollout was too quick, but given the givens, it was really clear that the agency learned from its past mistakes and took many steps that made it clear that they actually, you know, the recipients were among their primary considerations, despite the complexity of the rollout process. I will say that we have heard concerns similar to those expressed today by others around access to therapy services, durable medical equipment, transportation services, and certain specialty services. And we do know that the agency has been trying to address those issues, and the agency has been receptive to all the individual concerns that we've raised. So I need to say that. We'll continue to route recipients to the complaint hub, as well as to continue to monitor and understand what's happening system-wide. I did want to make one other point, however. The special terms is required that the agency hold this form within, if I'm correct, 6 months of implementation. I'm not sure when the clock started ticking on that requirement. However, the only way I know how to look at this is that MMA implementation continued until at least August 1st, when recipients in the last set of regions to roll out were enrolled in their MMA plans. And 6 months from that date is February 1st. Some recipients in MMA have only been enrolled for 7 weeks. And our concern is that as the continuity of care provisions and the transitional protections expire, the window before the lock-in period closes, the effective but artificial safety net that the agency has provided is being peeled away. And I would submit that that's not just sufficient for something to be concerned about. I would think it may be critical because going forward, it's going to become a lot less about looking at this is going to be a lot less about what the agency has done up to this point and more about what the plans really intend to do. And we know there are contracts, we know all those things. But the MMA we're going to see going forward is more of the real MMA than we have seen up to this point. And that's our concern. There's a risk that the value of the good work that the agency has done could be eroded by sort of the need to hold forums and declare victory before we see what the MMA program really looks like in normal operating mode. So we just urge you to continue doing everything you have been doing in the areas of accountability and transparency going forward and not let up at this point. Thanks for the opportunity to comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Mello. And I've been looking around to see if my waiver expert is here. But I believe that this is a forum that we are required to hold at least annually. But regardless, we will have public opportunities for input and comment on an ongoing basis. I think it's a point well taken that there are different phases to this. The early part of implementation is different than the later part, and it's different from what we call steady state, which is once everything kind of shakes out and people get settled into their plans and we move into normal ongoing operations. So I believe we couldn't agree more, and we will continue to hold open opportunities for people to comment. So thank you very much for your comments. Okay, Ms. Stottemauer.
Presentation mode is now enabled.
Thank you. I'm Casey Stottemauer. I'm with the Florida Dental Association. Melly and I have had numerous discussions on the rollout and how it relates to dentists and orthodontists throughout the state, but I just wanted to bring up just 4 points. The first one is, in Region 10, the South Florida Community Care Network is actually reimbursing dentists at below Medicaid rates. Florida is already 50 out of 50 on dental reimbursement. We really can't afford to go any lower. I didn't know we could go any lower. But they have, and it's not just a maybe 1-2% decrease. It is a very significant decrease. I've talked with several of my members, and they're saying if a Medicaid patient walks through the door that is a member of South Florida Community Care Network, they lose money. So it's actually better for them to provide that service for free than to treat a Medicaid patient in South Florida Community Care Network. So that's very concerning. We do understand that the plans are allowed to do that under the contract, and it just concerns us that once one plan starts doing it, other plans may, hopefully not, but may follow suit. On the opposite end of the spectrum, we have seen plans that are offering 110% of Medicaid rates, which sounds great, but when you start looking at the prior authorizations, they start playing with their prior authorizations and make it much more difficult to provide care. Example, nitrous, stainless steel crowns. Melly, I know you've heard from many members on those issues. So, yes, it sounds good that they're going to do 110% of Medicaid rates, but what they're really doing is making it more difficult on the back end with their prior authorizations and administrative burdens. The vast majority of dental care is being provided through, or, you know, the managed care plans have, the medical plans have subcontracted with existing dental managed care plans. United Healthcare is really the only one that is not using a dental managed care plan that was being utilized before. We've had some hiccups with United Healthcare, but we're working through those. Our main issue there is they're taking 6 months to credential. And our concern there is they are not reimbursing a dentist if they're in that credentialing process. So if a dentist has started the credentialing process with United Healthcare, it doesn't matter. They still have to wait 6 months. Now, for, you know, a pediatric dentist, it's not the greatest, but some of their patients, you know, may be able to get a cleaning somewhere else or something like that. Orthodontics is really where we're seeing the issue. You know, if you go to the orthodontist, you can't wait 6 months for your dentist, your orthodontist to be credentialed. You need to get in there and get your services done at that time. So, you know, when the continuity of care provision runs out and they're still trying to get credentialed during those 6 months, that's an issue. And then lastly, one of the managed care plans, Sunshine State, is currently subcontracting their dental out to MCNA. However, they are creating their own dental managed care company in-house, Dental Health and Wellness. There's been some confusion as they're trying to roll that out. They are actually credentialing dentists at this time because we know it's kind of a double-edged sword. They can't get approved by ACA to roll out dental health and wellness unless they can show that their network is adequate. That's creating confusions on the part of patients and providers because a provider will credential with dental health and wellness thinking they're going to get paid through dental health and wellness when, in fact, they need to get credentialed through MCNA if they want to see a Sunshine State plan recipient. So there's a little bit of confusion going on there, and that's just adding to some of the headaches that the dentists are experiencing. So with that, I thank you.
Thank you. I did want to comment on the orthodontics. We have a special provision in the continuity of care provisions that relate specifically to orthodontics, and it's really for that reason, because we know that there's no, because you can't go without getting the next adjustment or the next getting your braces off. And so we made some special provisions on that we can talk
about. And I would just make sure that UnitedHealthcare are aware of that. We've had a lot of issues with, we know what they're supposed to be doing, and usually the decision maker that I have contact with at UnitedHealthcare, the higher ups, know that, but it's maybe not trickling down to the provider relations folks that are actually speaking with the orthodontist or the recipients on a daily basis. So they're getting conflicting information.
Okay, great. And thank you for clarifying that. I can't reiterate enough how critical it is for these, if you're having trouble with this, these are large organizations and they are not off the hook for giving out bad information. But if we don't find out about it, then someone might take too long for them to get it corrected while the disconnect in the organization gets fixed. And so, it's a big change for everybody and we want to help facilitate those things getting corrected as quickly as possible. So putting the specifics into the hub does two things. One, it gets that individual their specific attention that they need to solve their problem, and it also gives us the bigger picture so we can track and trend and see if it's a problem with a specific plan. We've put out numerous clarifications where we see confusion across an area. So it really is our eyes and ears, so we really appreciate that. Thank you. Yes, Dr. Thacker.
Dr. Thacker, so I had a question about then the orthodontics aspect of it, and that there are provisions in place. Are one of those provisions to retroactively compensate the orthodontist? Let's say they're in that, as she mentioned, in that process of getting credentialed, and so we're taking care of the patient. And so does that mean that if they ultimately are credentialed and added to the panel, that then they will be compensated, or they're going to be compensated regardless? And what exactly is that?
So for orthodontics, our general continuity of care provision is that for the first 60 days after a person goes into a managed care plan, regardless of whether they were previously in fee-for-service, if they were previously in managed care, that they can continue with their current provider if they had previously authorized care for up to 60 days, and that that provider would be paid at the same rate for the first 30 days and then at a negotiated rate thereafter. That's the basic provision. Now, for certain special circumstances, we recognize that there might need to be something further. So one is obstetrics. If the woman has started her obstetrical care with one OBGYN or practitioner, they can stay with that person throughout the course of the pregnancy. For orthodontics, it's the same situation. They can stay with that orthodontist. The plan must continue to pay that orthodontist throughout the course of that individual's treatment, regardless. I believe that's right. I don't have it in front of me.
Yes, please.
I'll try to talk really loud.
No, that's not going to work. No.
It doesn't pick up on the recording. So.
After the continuity of care period, the plan can ask the recipient to use a provider, an orthodontist, in their network. But if they do not have an orthodontist in their network for the recipient to choose from, then they have to continue to reimburse the orthodontist that the recipient has been using.
Thank you. So there are a couple of cases like that that have special provisions. That's one of them. Yes, Dr. Payne.
Let me comment about Medicaid paying for orthodontics. There is a provision that says that Medicaid will pay for orthodontic therapy if the malocclusion is so that there's a medical reason for it to be done. So just to straighten out the perhaps misconception out there, every individual that is on Medicaid is not eligible to have orthodontics done.
It has to meet the medical necessity definition, and for orthodontics, it is a fairly severe malocclusion.
And you alluded to a minute ago about obstetrics, and so I just had a question in terms of reimbursement, and I realize it can be plan specific, but in general, for an obstetrician, they have to do prenatal visits, and then there's the delivery. Then there's the postpartum. And so how are obstetricians compensated? Is it just based on whoever delivers the child is the one that's compensated, or are there specific reimbursements for each prenatal visit? There's a fee and reimbursement for the delivery and a fee reimbursement for postpartum. And I wasn't clear on that.
Well, under fee-for-service, there's a reimbursement for each prenatal visit, for the delivery, and for the postpartum visit, and those are separate. Now, managed care organizations might contract with an OBGYN on a different kind of basis, such as a whole course of pregnancy or some kind of other arrangement. But again, that's between the provider and the managed care plan to arrange that. But under fee-for-service Medicaid, it's truly fee-for-service.
Right. So we're not involved with that necessarily, and ACA is not involved in the recommendations, and so we've relegated that strictly to the individual plan. Is that correct?
In terms of how they structure their payment arrangement, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Dr. Payne with the Florida Association. Just a follow-up on the six-month credentialing, and perhaps this is for Catherine Moffitt. Why should a plan have to take 6 months to credential anybody? That seems unreasonable.
Dr. Moffitt, would you like to take that?
I don't disagree with that. I'm not sure which plans we're talking about specifically. I can tell you that our accreditation bodies and ACA's own contract requires timeliness of credentialing. If I'm not mistaken, I think 180 days after the initial application is at the most that can be taken. But every attempt is made, at least in our organization, to do it a whole lot faster than that. I can tell you that this may sound hollow, but I'm gonna talk to my co-members at the Florida Association of Health Plans about everything I've heard here, including that, and find out, what is going on. Sometimes it's a two-way street. Sometimes the plan doesn't get information back from the provider. Sometimes, despite multiple requests and attempts, we don't get the information that we need. And the most important thing is to make sure that we don't credential a provider that we haven't fully vetted. But that said, as a global rule, it shouldn't take 6 months. I agree with you, Dr. Payne. So point well taken.
Dr. Payne, is that? Okay. So that concludes the comment period on the what we call the post-award forum, which is about the implementation of the program. We are going to switch gears. The last part of our meeting here is to talk about the comprehensive quality strategy. So what I'm going to suggest is that we go ahead and have Marie Donnelly, who's our bureau chief for what will soon to be named the Bureau of Quality, to go through the presentation on this. And then after that, we'll do questions and answers from this group just to kind of get a baseline understanding. And then what we'll do is that the subgroups will break out to the different rooms to talk about the quality strategy, and you'll have facilitators in each area. What I'm going to suggest, I know it's been a long meeting up to this point, but I'm going to suggest that we take a break of about 15 minutes between the end of this meeting and the convening of the subgroups for everybody to come to a break and move to their rooms. So does that sound like a reasonable approach? Okay, so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Marie Donnelly to talk to you a little bit about the quality strategy. Is it green? Okay, we need a different. Can we get a different mic, Carla or Millie? It's not. It should have turned.
Good afternoon. I'm Marie Donnelly. I am the Medicaid chief for quality. It's good to see some familiar faces here. I know some of you from my days as director of planning and budget at Agency for Persons with Disabilities, and also as the chief of the Pharmacy Bureau here for Medicaid. Today I'm going to tell you how ACA has reorganized to sharpen its focus on quality and outcomes as we've transitioned mostly to managed care. I think Mr. Mello just mentioned we want to know how we look in normal operating mode or steady state, as we often say here, and that is why this focus has been put on quality to even at the bureau level in the reorganization. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that today and also about the draft comprehensive quality strategy document that I'm sure this group is familiar with, and that's an updated version for 2014. And as you know, that's a requirement, federal requirement, for the agency to produce that. And we are working from the slides in this presentation regarding quality for the group. In addition to just monitoring the contract compliance and the state and federal mandates that are in the contract and in statute, this quality group's mission is to move beyond that, to bring innovation and improvements to the way the agency works with its health plan partners. And the goal, of course, is to provide positive outcomes for all Medicaid recipients. Our group will be data-driven. We will use evidence that we can gather to develop new solutions, initiate communications with the plans, and we all are, again, focused on the same goal. We view this group as the feedback loop for the entire agency and for health plans to be able to keep our finger on the pulse of the quality that our health plans can deliver. And we will be doing that through monitoring, measuring, and then making constant improvements through feedback loop. There are four units in this new quality bureau. The performance evaluation and research unit. Some of you have probably worked with Rachel LaCroix, who heads up this unit. We have a clinical quality review and initiatives unit, Dr. Alicia Coley, who is a PharmD in our pharmacy fee-for-service organization. Many of you have worked with Dr. Coley. Clinical and care coordination unit. Many of you have worked with Carol Barr Platt in the Bureau of Managed Health Care on the behavioral health plan monitoring. That's who's heading, Carol Barr Platt will be heading that up. And then we still have a fee-for-service utilization management unit. There is still a fee-for-service program. Mentioned that several times today. There are still a few hundred thousand people in fee-for-service who are receiving services through fee-for-service. That sounds small to Florida Medicaid. It's larger probably than some whole state Medicaid programs, so we do still have fee-for-service for those folks. I won't go into detail on each of those four. There's a little more detail in your slide deck there about each of the four units. And if you have any questions, please do contact me. I want to get us to break time and have time for the workout or breakout sessions too. The comprehensive strategy, as I mentioned, is required by CMS. And the document you have in your packet is an update of the quality strategy that was approved by CMS. A comprehensive and continuous improvement strategy is required as a condition of approval for the MMA. This quality group will be involved in that. This document demonstrates to CMS that ACA ensures access, quality, and continuity of care, that we utilize partnerships with other agencies, that we document improved outcomes, and that we coordinate with the external quality review organizations. And as you know, the contracts require that each of the plans have improvement plans, and we will be working with each of those. This report is organized in several basic sections. There's an introduction, assessment, improvement, the review, and then achievements and opportunities. That's the most interesting section. Shows the ways that the agency is increasing accountability, the additional performance standards that we'll be employing, provider network requirements and how well we're doing with that, selective contracting, consumer report cards, and feedback directly from consumers, and evidence that we're providing comprehensive and coordinated care through the managed care. We have executed contracts with 20 managed care plans, as you know, including specialty plans. The long-term care rollout and MMA rollout is complete, so we'll be focusing on several of those steps in this draft. The comment period for this draft has begun and will close on October 15th. What we really want to know, besides specific potential edits to this document from you, is really a broader focus. Are we really focused on the right quality areas? Are there other places we should be looking, other topics that we should be exploring? Do our measures make sense? Would there be better ways to measure our success? And is the report usable and understandable? And not just this report, but anything that we produce moving forward in a more broad context of ensuring quality for Medicaid in managed care. The last page of the presentation has the contact information for Wendy Smith. She is collecting comments and edits for the Comprehensive Quality Strategy document. Again, the comment period ends on October 30th, and I would be happy to hear from you directly, my ACA email, on these and any other topics related to quality and ongoing monitoring of that and improvement of that as we move forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Marie. You put that there. Okay, questions or comments from the committee members? Mr. Whitaker.
I read through the document and made a few notes, and rather than discuss them individually, I'll just turn that into you.
Yes.
And that, in the interest of time.
Thank you. We'd be happy to take them that way. Thank you. Are there questions about the structure of the report?
I just have a comment. This is Dr. Payne from the Florida Dental Association. In evaluating how the plans are doing, throughout this document talks about HEDIS measures of evaluation. And I have a problem with some of the HEDIS measures, and the primary problem I have with it is they're more encounter-oriented as opposed to procedure code-oriented. And, again, I get up in my soapbox and say, unless you get procedure codes, you really don't know what's going on. So my comment would be, whenever you can, see if you can get specific procedure codes, because just encounter measures provide the network.
This conference has been running for an extended period. The chairperson can press star 1 to continue with this conference. The conference has been extended.
I'm sorry.
That was a correct minute. Statement. I think we'll all agree with that.
I'm sorry. I think it just said it was extended 1 minute. I apologize. We might get interrupted again. That was my hastiness to not listen to the whole message. So Dr. Payne, you're saying
whenever possible, if you would use procedure codes to evaluate and not just provider networks and number of encounters, you get a much more accurate gauge of what actually is going on.
Thank you for that comment, and you've got an ally in me for that. I'm total data geek, and I'll be looking at the encounter information.
Great. Are there comments or questions about the report, about the structure of the report? Okay, so let me tell you where we're going to go from here, physically and otherwise. Wanted to make sure that you knew that the next MCAC meeting, before we break out in subgroups, the next meeting is tentatively scheduled for January 13th, so in the new year. However, we will have a subgroup meeting, a series of subgroup meetings to talk about consumer report cards, and sometime a little bit later this fall, probably mid to late November. And so Carla is working on scheduling that with the subcommittees. The next steps that we have will be for you all to go to your, with your subgroup leaders to the different rooms on this floor. So you will all be in this area. Some of you may be familiar with the rest of our conference rooms, which if you go down the hall past the elevators on your right, you'll make an immediate right, and the rooms are all in a row right there. And so I'll call out who is, where each group is going. And if I can ask the leaders of the group, each group to stand up.
We also have folks outside with signs that have their.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
That will lead you to the conference rooms that you need to go to. They're bright yellow signs.
Okay.
You'll be able to find your conference room.
Perfect. So what I'll do is I'll tell you which rooms. And I would say if these groups could convene then at 3:40, that would give you about a 15-minute break to use the restrooms and find your room. Again, if anybody's lost, we'll have people to direct you. So let me run through the different groups. The managed long-term care group will stay in this room. Your leaders will be Dee Dee Pickle and Eunice Medina. So,
Tracy Hurd.
Oh, and Tracy Hurd, I'm sorry, sitting in for, Eunice today. The behavioral health and substance abuse group will be in conference room B. That'll be the first one you come to down the hall. And your leaders for that are Taisha Washington and Kimberly Houston. All right, so stand up a little longer. And Taisha and Kimberly, all right, will be your leaders, so you can look for them in conference room B. The children's group will be in conference room C for children. That's easy to remember. LaKira Reddick and Katie Weatherington. Kira and Katie, all right, will be your leaders for that. And the HIV-AIDS subcommittee will move. Actually, they'll be in going left down the hallway instead of right. And that will be Sophia Whaley and Tamara Zanders. Oh, and see, they have to be different as well. So Sophia's on that side. Follow her. Okay. Okay. So are there any other concluding questions or comments from the... Oh, I'm sorry. Did I skip dental? Dental? Skipped right over dental. Erica Floyd Thomas and Pam Hall. And that is in conference room D for dental. Wow. Okay. My apologies for that. I do think a lot about dental all the time. Amy, go ahead.
Do we still need this, sir?
Yes,
okay.
We do.
I know we'll probably talk a little bit more about the specifics when we break into our group, but for now, could you just kind of give us a general idea of kind of input or feedback that you're looking from each of the subcommittees? And I know one of our responsibilities, requirements, and special terms and conditions is to provide feedback on this. So, but could you kind of just give us a general idea for those of us, some people who might be attending these meetings
sure.
who aren't as familiar with it.
Absolutely. I think your facilitators will have some questions, kind of get the conversation going. I think we can take comments from the macro level, or we can take very specific kinds of comments. I think the comments about maybe we're not using the right kinds of measures, maybe we need something more specific, it doesn't really tell you enough. Those are very legitimate kinds of comments. We struggle sometimes with what we're measuring and whether we're measuring the right things. So some of the things you could answer are we focused on the right areas? Are we completely missing the mark on something where we should be having some area of focus and quality, or should be measuring something? Should we be increasing our focus? Should we be measuring differently with different types of measures, additional types of ways of looking at how we're meeting our outcomes? The report itself, it's a voluminous document. There's a lot of federal requirements around it, but to the extent that we can, we try to make it to be a usable document that really, let me say that over the last 2-3 years, we worked very hard to make it from very technical kind of compliance-oriented document that we just sent to the feds to make it something that really reflects what we are working to do with quality and managed care. And so if we have missed the mark on that and you have any kind of comments about that, I am always really open to that as well, to say how do we make this more understandable, more user-friendly. And maybe there's areas that You know, you feel like we don't need to focus anymore. Maybe we're done with that and we need to move on to something else. So those are the kinds of things we're looking for.
And I'm sorry, just to follow up. So are you looking for like more formal report from each of the subcommittees, or could they be responding individually through the comment period as a member of the subcommittee? Or kind of understand what I'm saying. Is it a group effort that we should all be working together, or should we do it separately?
I understand, but thank you. That's good clarification. You'll have people taking notes in each of the subcommittees so that the comments that you have that emerge out of that will be captured and become part of the comment record. So you as a subcommittee do not have to then go back and write up a report. We will do that. We'll take minutes of the subcommittee, send them back out to you all for approval that it accurately reflects what the subcommittee talked about, and that'll become part of the comment record. In terms of you all making individual comments, as Mr. Whitaker has on behalf of his organization, we absolutely welcome that. We know that each of you represent different areas and they have different kind of very much more specific focus. And that's why the comment period is open for written comments to come in other ways. Does that help? Okay, thank you. That's good. Okay, so with that, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. If we can, I'm actually going to say towards 3:45, be in your rooms. If you need any help, ask a staff person. Okay.